Well, friends, many of you will be familiar with the trilogy, The Lord of the Rings, whether it's the books or the movies. And the story, of course, is basically a quest, and it's a quest to destroy the ring. And it's a rip-roaring yarn, a yarn that involves action and adventure and danger and courage and treachery and eventually success. The ring is destroyed, and the quest ends in triumph. And friends, all throughout history, humankind has been on a quest, the quest to find meaning and fulfillment. And through the centuries, philosophers have continually speculated about this quest, what makes the good life, what gives fulfillment and meaning to human life. And in a sense, our culture today encourages us to pursue this very same quest, a quest for meaning and purpose, to live a full life, a fulfilling life. Our culture actually encourages us in this day and age on a quest for pleasure, a life of pleasurable experiences in order to have that fulfilling life. But in order that we might pursue these pleasurable experiences, we need material wealth, says our culture. Our culture tells us that with money, there's whole industries that'll provide meaning and fulfillment for us. They'll provide us with the pleasures we want, like restaurants and bars and travel agents and timeshare holiday clubs and cruise companies and people who build our dream home for us. And then, of course, in our culture, there's the middlemen, there's the financial planners and the superannuation funds, and they're integral to the whole thing. In fact, the superannuation ads have been telling us for years that they're here to help the most important person in the world, you or me, so that we can have enough money to retire early and pursue the lifestyle of our dreams, which might include working through our bucket list, you know, the things you really must do, our culture tells us, those things you must do before you kick the bucket. So, friends, our culture largely teaches us to pursue prosperity and pleasure. In fact, the greater the prosperity, the greater the pleasure. The more money you have, the wider the ranges of pleasures that you can pursue, and the more time and opportunity you have to pursue them. So you'd think, friends, that in our culture, in which we're all living full lives, all working hard, making money, enjoying pleasures, or working hard making money so that one day we can enjoy those pleasures, you'd think that our culture would be full of people with full lives, which are all so fulfilling, lives which are so very rewarding, so worthwhile. You'd think we'd all be so happy. But friends, that's not the case, is it? Australia, one of the very wealthiest countries in the world, has one of the highest suicide rates. And on the news this week, they said that in Australia, we have one of the highest rates per capita of prescriptions for antidepressants. But perhaps I'm being a bit harsh with contemporary Australian culture, because, of course, we're not the only society that's tried to fill our lives with pleasure and prosperity as an end in themselves, as the meaning and purpose of life. In fact, we'll see today that this path's been trod before. It's a path that's laid out for us and examined in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, friends, the main speaker in Ecclesiastes is a bloke called the Preacher. And the Preacher sets out to think wisely about how we should live in this world. And he comes across as a secularist, actually. It's not that he doesn't believe in God. He's not an atheist. He just doesn't think that God's very involved in the world. The Preacher, a bit like many of us Aussies, happily acknowledges the existence of God, but he just doesn't think God's relevant to his life. And the Preacher thinks about life from a particular perspective, the perspective of King Solomon, famous throughout the whole world of his day, both for his wisdom and his incredible wealth. In a sense, the Preacher looks at life through the eyes of Solomon and walks in the shoes of Solomon, setting out on his quest to find the meaning of life. But being a secularist, the Preacher restricts his investigation to what can be observed under the sun. That's a key phrase that's found in chapter 1, verse 3. Life under the sun is life as we experience it in the here and now, physical, material world, without reference to God. Life under the sun without taking God into account. And the preacher's ultimate conclusion, as we saw last week, is very bleak, actually. It's disturbingly bleak. The conclusion is that everything under the sun is vanity. All of life under the sun is transient, temporary, futile, meaningless. Well, with that happy thought in mind, let's look at today's passage. So here the preacher himself sets out on his quest to find the meaning of life, the purpose of life. And in verse 13, the preacher summarizes his quest. He says, "And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven." And here, under heaven means the same as under the sun, life in this material world without reference to God, secular life. And he's going to investigate it all, he says. But right up front, he says this life is not very inspiring. He says, verse 13, "It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with." That is, he warns us in advance that this secular life lived under the sun is futile and pointless. See in verse 14, "I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind." All of life is vanity, meaningless. It's like playing chasey with the wind. It's pointless because you can never catch it. And why is life meaning and pointless? Well, it's a bit like Arthur Dent from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy would say. There's something fundamentally wrong with our universe. Life under the sun is meaningless and futile because something's gone wrong. And verse 15 is a poetic way of just saying that. It says, "What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted." Friends, because of what we call the fall, when our first parents rebelled against God, the world's tragically and profoundly damaged. It's not the way it should have been. It's crooked and distorted. And friends, we can't make it straight. Under the sun, we just have to live with it. We can no more fix the fundamental crookedness of the world than we can count something that's not actually there. It just can't be done. Well, let's now think about the detail of the preacher's quest from chapter 2. And the first path the preacher takes on his quest is pleasure. And that sounds like a good place to start, and I think I'd probably start there too. So he tries wine in verse 3, you know, a drop of the doings. He tries the party scene, like many have before and since. He sets out experimenting with cheering his body with alcohol. That is, getting at least a bit tipsy. And probably he would have felt good for a while. But notice in verse 3, he laid hold of folly in his wine drinking. And that strongly suggests that he drank enough to cause him to display folly in his behaviour. Enough drinking to cause him to behave foolishly. And drinking alcohol in more than a careful, modest way usually does end in folly. Drinking for the sake of drinking may be fun for a little while, but it ends badly, either in being broke the next morning and not having enough money to provide for yourself or your family, or it results in a thumper of a headache, or in violence, or in regrets about how you spoke to someone, or about someone, or in how you treated someone. So the party life actually is not much of a party after all. Eventually, it wreaks havoc in families, in lives, and in society. Looking for meaning and purpose in the pleasure of too much grog is a dead-end street, as are drugs. There's some pleasure in the moment, but there are always bad consequences. So the next pleasure he tries, from verse 4, is possessions. Maybe they'll do the trick for him. Grogging on was a bit pointless, really. What about stuff? Now, friends, we live in a consumer culture. We know about possessions. We know about accumulating stuff. In fact, our culture idolizes stuff and gadgets and big toys for big boys and expensive collectibles. I was once advised by a lady who would have considered herself quite sophisticated. I was advised how very worthwhile it is to surround yourself with nice things. Very agreeable and pleasant. Perhaps they'll make me feel better about myself, and they'll provide meaning to my life. Perhaps when I'm feeling a bit low and a bit unappreciated or a bit stressed, I'll hit the shopping centre for some retail therapy and I'll buy some nice stuff, whether I can afford it or whether I can't. And then I'll feel better, or at least until I get the Visa card bill. Well, friends, your capacity to accumulate possessions and mine will have some limit. It's limited by our income, isn't it? But what if you had all the wealth imaginable, like Solomon did? Remember, he was the richest man in the ancient world. What if you could have anything in the world you wanted, like Solomon could? The house or the houses, the cars, the boat, the holiday house, the overseas trips? Well, the preacher recounts Solomon's experience in all these things. Look at verse 4 to 8 in chapter 2. So Solomon's got houses, vineyards, gardens, parks, fruit trees, pools, slaves, herds and flocks, silver and gold, and the treasure of kings and provinces. This bloke absolutely had it all in terms of possessions. He had anything money could buy, anything money could build, he had it. He was really living the dream. As if he'd won Tats Lotto many times over, or perhaps as if he'd won this week's Powerball. He had any possession his heart desired, he went out and he got it. And notice in those verses, he did it all for himself, for his own self-fulfillment, his own pleasure. But not only possessions, he also satisfied other desires, so he had the ultimate entertainment. In verse 8, we see that he had male and female singers to entertain him any time he wanted. And he had many concubines, basically slave wives, to fulfill his every whim any time he wanted. In fact, Solomon, whose life is being portrayed here by the preacher, had 300 concubines as well as 700 wives. So friends, this man lived the life of the rich and famous. He had it all: pleasure from drink, from wealth and possessions, from a high and mighty lifestyle, from unlimited sex. And from verse 10, we saw that whatever he wanted, he just took. He denied himself nothing, he says. He went about it with gusto. Chasing pleasure was in fact a project for him, and he devotedly worked at it. His quest for pleasure was, in a sense, work or toil, verse 10. And in that sense, he did find some satisfaction in this work. But friends, what did he conclude? What did it all mean at the end of the day? Look with me at verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in it doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So despite having absolutely everything money could buy, every imaginable pleasure, he concludes it's all meaningless. It's chasing the wind. It's pointless. There's no net gain under the sun. He was looking for fulfillment and he'd absolutely not found it in pleasure. And friends, this is, of course, is a story we're all sadly familiar with. As you know, it's the sad tale of many rock stars and movie stars and other wealthy celebrities. They get fabulously rich and many throw themselves into the party lifestyle because they've got the money to do so. But tragically, many experience grief one way or another in their personal lives. Limitless pleasure ends up being no pleasure at all. It ends up being meaningless. So friends, if pleasure doesn't give meaning and fulfillment to life, what does? Well, we're going to be looking at chapter 2, verses 18 and following now. And perhaps the answer to what's going to give us meaning and purpose is work. Perhaps a great career will do it. And of course, work's a good thing. We've been made in God's image, and God's a creating and working God. He created the world and he sustains it. So it's good to work. As people made in God's image, it's good to work. And work is also a way of providing for ourselves. We need food, we need clothes for our back, we need shelter. And all of those who are able, we should provide these things for ourselves, unless illness or disability or unemployment prevents us. And we should think about providing for the future as well. So it's good to work hard in your job, in your career, to provide for today and plan for tomorrow. But friends, we can devote so much to our work that we neglect our responsibilities to our families or to others, or we are just too busy. And anyway, what happens when you die? What happens when to all you've worked for then? Now, of course, ordinarily it'll go to your spouse to provide for him or her. But what if you're not married? Or what if your spouse has already died? Who's it go to then? Well, probably to your kids. But they haven't worked for it. And if you haven't got kids, it might go to some distant relative. And he or she hasn't lifted a finger to provide it. And you'll have no say in how it's spent. You worked hard for it. It was yours. Now you're gone and someone else gets to spend it. And you've got no say in whether it's used wisely or foolishly. So what's the point of that? And friends, this very, very thought consumes the preacher from verse 18. He says it drives him to hate his toil, his work. He can't control whether all that he's worked for under the sun will go to a wise man or to a fool. And he finds this to be meaningless in verse 19. It drives him to despair in verse 20. In fact, it's so meaningless, so futile, that in verse 21 he calls it a great evil. It's just not right. It's pointless. Working hard day in, day out is wearying. In fact, working life, verse 23, is often just plain hard work. You know, there's the early starts, the long days, the office politics, the unfair bosses, the manipulative employees. Under the sun, working life is often full of sorrow and vexation, in verse 23. Or as the NIV version of the Bible puts it, it's full of grief and pain. Friends, so much so that even when we're exhausted from all our work and we collapse into our beds, we can't sleep. We toss and we turn, worrying about work issues. So friends, why would we wear ourselves out working year in and year out when there's no guarantee that we won't drop dead tomorrow and that whatever we've accumulated will go to someone else who won't value it and who may fritter it away foolishly? That's the question the preacher asks. So the preacher doesn't find any meaning of life in pleasure, and he certainly doesn't find it in work or career or accumulating wealth. So where else could he look? Well, the third path to fulfillment that the preacher tries is wisdom, and we read about that in chapter 1 from verse 16. He tries wisdom. So maybe, he thinks, philosophy's where it's at, seeking understanding to make meaning in life. Maybe, friends, all we need to do is just slow down and think hard enough and long enough about life, and we'll discover the meaning of life, that we'll discover fulfillment. But just think with me for a moment about what we see on the evening news and in the newspapers and on the internet. We see violence and war and injustice and oppression and exploitation and inequity and addiction and relationship breakdown. We see all these things. Modern life under the sun is full of them. They're everywhere. They're entrenched systemically and they're unfixable. In fact, friends, applying the wisdom and philosophy, all the wisdom and philosophy under the sun that we have, these things still end up being meaningless. Under the sun, life itself is meaningless, like chasing after the wind. And in fact, that's exactly the conclusion the preacher comes to in chapter 1, verse 16 to 18. So although he'd acquired much wisdom, he says, and applied his heart to discern wisdom and folly, his depressing conclusion is that this also is striving after the wind. Friends, trying to work life out by ourselves under the sun is a sorry and wearisome affair. In fact, the more we know of the world and its problems, the more likely we are just to get depressed rather than being able to solve those problems. You see, those who are happiest in life are not the philosophers who read and write thick books with no pictures in them. Look at verse 18 in chapter 1. He writes, "For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow." No, thinking long and hard about life under the sun is certainly not likely to make you happy. Those who think about these are not the happiest people in the world. And in fact, those who are the happiest people in the world, it seems, are little children. Little kids always seem to be the happiest ones. And why? Well, it's just that they haven't lived long enough yet to know any different. But friends, that's not to say we shouldn't think wisely and carefully about life, especially how we should live our life. And Socrates said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." So, of course, it is better to live wisely than foolishly. And the preacher says as much in chapter 2 from verse 13. He says, "Wisdom is better than foolishness, just like light is better than darkness." So, overall and generally speaking, life goes better when people think carefully how to live, rather than behaving foolishly or recklessly. Yet when all is said and done, both wise people and foolish people will die. So in chapter 2, verse 14, the preacher says, "The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, 'What happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise?' And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool." He says, even wise people die, just like foolish people die. And the preacher's conclusion? Having considered the relative merits of wisdom and foolishness? Well, he says, verse 17, that he hates life. He hates life under the sun. It causes him grief. At the end of the day, under the sun, the wise are no better off than the foolish. They both die, and the preacher finds the whole thing to be meaningless, no more fruitful than chasing after the wind. Well, friends, today we've listened to the preacher, not me, to the preacher of Ecclesiastes, and we've followed him while he's been on his quest to find the meaning of life. And we've learnt from the preacher that real meaning, real fulfilment, is not found in pleasure or work and career and wealth accumulation or even in human wisdom. Life under the sun, life in the secular world without God, is meaningless and ultimately ends in death. Under the sun, life sucks, and then you die. So friends, can any meaning be found anywhere? Friends, is there any hope for any of us? Well, fortunately there is. Look with me at 1 Corinthians chapter 1 on page 952. So I'll read from verse 18. So this is the Apostle Paul writing, and he says, "For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, 'I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart.' Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Friends, here at last is wisdom. Here is fulfillment. Here is meaning. Jesus, the one who came from God, who came from beyond the Son, is the wisdom of God. He's the one who brings meaning to life and fulfillment. He's the one who died on the cross to break the curse of the fall, to pay for the sin and rebellion of humanity, mine and yours. Jesus breaks the curse of punishment for our sin and the curse of meaninglessness in life under the sun. Because now there's hope for life that's not restricted to being under the sun. Now, because of Jesus' death and resurrection, there is hope for eternal life. Eternal life now in a new eternal life in a new creation where life won't be meaningless or futile or pointless. And this new eternal life can begin now, right now, by trusting in Jesus. The wisdom of the world says pursue pleasure, try sex, drugs and rock and roll to have a good life. Or perhaps work hard, accumulate wealth and then spend like crazy because you're a long time dead. But God's wisdom says trust in Jesus. In fact, God's wisdom is Jesus. He's the one that brings meaning and purpose and fulfillment to life. He brings eternal life. And you, friend, can find that life by turning away from living life your own way, by turning away from ignoring God, from treating God as if he's not relevant, from living life only under the sun. You can find that life by asking God to forgive all rebellion against him, as many of us here have. And friend, if you're not already a person who's trusting in Jesus, then friend, that's something I'd really urge you to do. And I'd urge you to do it today. Not primarily so that you'll know new purpose and meaning in life today, though you will, but friend, so you will have eternal life with God, that you'll know the most meaningful and purposeful existence possible forever.